All right. I had these passed out before church. These are the charts. I misspoke when I said in the previous Bible study, I think it's in the old 1960 booklet, the Book of Revelation Unveiled at Last. It is not. It is in the old 1960 book, Who is the Beast? And we had a lady who had the booklet. I do have the booklet, but I have it bound up, hardbound, with other booklets of that era of time because I wanted to preserve them and not lose them. So I couldn't just open it up and get a good copy of it, but Carol Volker over there had it, and she could take the staple off at the middle and open it up to page 9 and spread it out and come up with an 8.5 by 11. The church has not changed in any of this, and of course, the reason I brought it up is we were in Daniel chapter 7 last time, and the four, the four beasts and the little horn and so on. Now, before we get into, we're going to go to Daniel 8 this time. I do have some questions that I need to cover here with you and all of that. Here's one of you submitted. Where was Daniel when his three friends were thrown into the furnace? Well, I don't know. If any of you have an answer, please let me know. And the Bible doesn't say. That's one of those kind of questions that, if it doesn't say, we don't know. And that's all I can say. He obviously wasn't close to his three friends at that point in time, or he would have been present when all of that happened. But that wasn't the case, so who knows. Daniel, of course, knew where he was. And God knows where he was at that time. But Daniel assembled what we call the Book of Daniel probably around 530 B.C. in the period of the 6th century. B.C. And a number of things he wrote, obviously, before 530, but he assembled it all together into what we call Daniel at that time. It's like today we're going to look at a vision that he received about 20 years before he assembled it into this book. Obviously, he wrote it down and everything because he had it when he put it all together, which explains why that much of the book of Daniel is not in a chronological order of events or anything. It's, for example, chapter 5, Belshazzar and the fall of Babylon is in 539. What we're going to look at today is 11 years before, and yet it's three chapters after chapter 5. After baptism, the minister asks the Father to give his spirit to the one baptized. Romans 8:9. If a person does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not or does not belong to Christ. When do we receive the Spirit of Christ as we officially receive the Spirit of the Father after baptism? Well, it's the same Spirit. And because Christ is also God, John 1:1. And so he just simply interplay of words, the Spirit of Christ or the Spirit of God, you're saying it's the same Spirit. There's not two separate or different spirits. Now this one, I'll take a little time before we go into the Bible study. What part of the Passover, which is coming up in just a few more months, isn't it? April the 13th is the Passover this year, or next year now. What part of the Passover service did Judas Iscariot take part in? Anybody know? Well, let's go see if we can find out. I'll tell you what the church has taught. Well, I'll just tell you at the outset, and then let's go look and we'll see why we've come to that conclusion. That is, that he took part in the foot washing, but not in the partaking of the bread and the wine. There are four accounts of the final Passover, and let's start with Matthew. We'll take them in order. Matthew 26. Actually, this question is from Miami, but I thought it'd be interesting for you as well, and to look it up. Matthew 26, verse 21. Now as they were eating, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each of them began to say to him, "Lord, is it I?" And then he answered and he said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me." Well, that doesn't really spell it out, does it? Because they're sitting at a table and it's being passed around. Each one dips into the dish as it goes by. It's not just one person. It's all 12. Verse 24, the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. Then Judas, who was betraying him. Now, that's a correct way to render it. It wasn't that he did at that moment. He had already conspired with the priests and Pharisees and to receive the money. So he was in the act of already betraying him, Christ, answered and said, Rabbi, is it I? And he said to him, you have said it. You have said it. All right, then everything stops right at the end of 25, and we start a new subject. And as they were eating, now what were they eating? They were eating the Passover meal that they'd gone in early to prepare, and in the second floor of this building where they had a room to do this. The reason why I want you to note that is that the situation with Judas, that somebody here is going to betray me, they were all sitting at dinner. And that took place before he gave the symbols for the unleavened bread and for the wine that would come later. So there's something happens between 25 and 26. All right. Now we'll go to Mark 14. Mark 14. And have Mark's account. Let's see what he has to say about it. And starting in verse 18. Now as they sat and ate, Jesus said, Assuredly I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me. And they began to be sorrowful and to say to him, one by one, Is it I? And another said, Is it I? In other words, this is the same as Matthew's account. And at the end of verse 21, between 21 and 22, because in 22 he begins to, as they were eating, to take the bread and break it and bless it. Okay, just like in Matthew's account. So here we have two accounts, Matthew and Mark, and what has happened? He brings up this betrayal before he gets into the blessing, breaking and blessing of the bread and the praying over the wine. This was not something he announced in advance. We have no knowledge that he told them, now tonight at this Passover will be different than the previous Passovers you've had with me. I'm going to introduce some new symbols. He didn't say anything about it. He just did it when the time came. Just did it when the time came. Let's go to Luke's account, Luke 22. Luke 22. They did not know, in other words, in advance, that he was going to introduce these new symbols. In Luke 22, and notice in verse 14 through 20, there here Luke's account describes the breaking, blessing of the bread, praying over it, and over the wine. And when that is finished, then Luke, in verse 21 through 23, brings up, Behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table where they were all sitting around to eat. Okay? So Luke put it after the blessing. So which is it? Matthew and Mark talk about the Christ bringing up the betrayal before the blessing of the bread and the wine. Luke mentions it afterwards. Now we need to take a look at consider a couple things. Mark and Luke were not present. Matthew and John, who we're going to go to next, were. And Mark gets his information according to the commentaries from Peter. And Luke would be getting it from Paul, who was also getting it from others. And Luke also got some from Mary. Early in his book of Luke, he makes references to Mary on a couple occasions, and which indicate her as a source of information of Christ at the time after he was born. All right, let's go to John 13. John 13. Luke is accumulating, and you have to keep in mind, throughout the book of Luke, he does not put things in chronological order. He writes more to a Greek audience, so he puts it according to subject. It's not in order. Matthew would, because he's writing to the Jews and they like things done that way. For example, if you go through many of the parables and so forth are all categorized by subject in the book of Luke, and not in the order that he gave it through the 3.5 years of his ministry. In John 13, verse 1, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Verse 2, and supper being ended. No, it wasn't. The Greek means during supper. So during supper, then he proceeds, and this is interesting, it always has kind of been a curiosity to me, why the other three writers never said anything about the foot washing. But John, 60 years later, writes in detail on how that Peter resisted him and everything. It's quite interesting. But John leaves out the bread and the wine, doesn't he? Why does he do that? Well, he doesn't need to because it's already been covered. He fills in something the others left out because he writes long after, well, some of them, well, they were dead, actually, when John writes what we call John. All right, but what we want to, after the foot washing in verse 17 is completed there, let's take a look down, verse 21. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Okay, when does he do, what do we just found out here? Judas participated in the foot washing, right? Because we drop down a little bit further. Well, let's read the rest of it. Verse 22, then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. And, of course, that was John. And then Peter, therefore, motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. Then leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread. And when I have dipped it, and having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now, it doesn't say, but I'm not sure he may have also, well, they were all dipping in the sop, as the other accounts said. Apparently, he did give a piece of bread here, maybe only to Judas. Verse 27, now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. And then Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. But no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. For some thought, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus had said to him, buy those things that we need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. Okay. Now we know that Judas was there for the foot washing. All right, that's what this whole chapter is about. He's one of the 12 whose feet were washed by Christ. Verse 30, having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately. Okay, and it was night. Verse 31, so when he had gone out, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. Now, what would come next? Obviously, the bread and the wine. But Judas went out immediately. And John left the bread and the wine out of the service, only the foot washing, because the other three have already covered it. And for the whole first century, everybody knows about the Passover on the 14th, and that's when they're doing it, as 1 Corinthians 11 even showed that church there in Corinth. So we know that Judas participated in the foot washing. He did not participate in that which was blessed for the forgiveness of sin, and the bread and, excuse me, the wine. And he never even knew about it. He never knew about it. And the other disciples did not know he was going to do that until after Judas was gone. And that's when he did it. So Luke's account, even though Luke is the only one that puts the one of you betray me after he has written about the symbols of the Passover, it's just because Luke is categorizing, not because it happened in that order. Because it's hard to follow anything in order, time-wise, in Luke's account. He categorizes all events together. All right, so I hope I've answered that. And now let's go to the book of Daniel, chapter 8. And when you turn to chapter 8, I have a question about chapter 7, which is from, again, Miami, but since I gave the same study here, I need to cover it here. All right, in Daniel 7, you might recall in verse 13 and 14, as I read it, I explained that the Son of Man, in verse 13, is Christ, and the Ancient of Days is the Father, God the Father. The question, Daniel 7, verse 22, it says the Ancient of Days is Christ, not God the Father. Please explain. Well, that's correct. It does say that. Remember, the Ancient of Days is simply an expression being used and applied. It is applied to the Father in verse 13. All of the commentaries I looked at on this, by the way, recognize that the Ancient of Days in chapter 13, verse 13, is the Father. They will say God rather than Father, except for Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, which I'm going to read to you here in just a moment, uses the term Father. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown did a very good job of explaining the situation here in chapter 7, verse 22. Well, let's read 21, 22. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. All right, the Ancient of Days came, and in this case, the Ancient of Days term is being applied to Christ. He's the one who would come. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, a good conservative commentary, says this: the title applied to Father, or to the Father, in verse 13, is here applied to the Son, who is called the Everlasting Father in Isaiah 9, verse 6. Now catch this. The Father is never said to, quote, come. It is the Son who comes. All right, turn back, verse 13. I was watching in the night visions. Behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And, of course, same here in verse 22, until the Ancient of Days came. It is the Son who comes, not the Father. And it's always, when it's referring to the Son, he is coming. Now, the Son of Man in verse 13 is coming or came. And here in verse 22, it is came. The Father does not do the coming. It is the Son who does the coming. That's a very good point. Something else for your information here on verse 22, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints. Judgment includes rule. Kingdom, in the end of this verse, where they will possess the kingdom, let me start that again. Kingdom, in the end of this verse, Christ first receives judgment and the kingdom, and then the saints with him. In that order. Quite interesting there too. I hadn't thought about it that way. Judgment, kingdom, and saints. In that order. Of course, saints receiving it then with him. One other point here I wanted to add to chapter 7, verse 13. Where notice that the Son of a Man coming on with the clouds of heaven. Coming with the clouds of heaven. Let me give you three scriptures where Christ said he would come on the clouds in the Gospels. In Mark 13 and verse 26, the Olivet Prophecy, Christ said that he would come on clouds. Matthew 24:30, the Olivet Prophecy, again, he would be coming on clouds. And the third time is Matthew 26 and verse 64. One other thing about the term Son of Man here, just to add to it in verse 13, remember that this is in the Aramaic or Chaldean language, chapters 2 through 7. Now, what we're going to, in a moment here, start in chapter 8, that goes back to Hebrew. But Daniel wrote in the Chaldean language, or the Aramaic. Old Aramaic is what it is. Now, the term Son of Man in the Old Aramaic in chapter 7 is Barnas, B-A-R, space, Nas, N-A-S, Barnas. Now, its Hebrew equivalent is Ben-Adam, B-E-N-Adam, Ben-Adam, and is used here as a divine personage. Now, Ben-Adam is used throughout the book of Ezekiel. And then, of course, you'll find in the book of John in the New Testament, Son of Man. That's what Jesus always referred to himself as, Son of Man. And almost every commentary without exception that I know of recognizes clearly what Jesus was saying to the Pharisees, Sadducees, or anyone else when they wanted to know who he was. He was saying, Son of Man. What he really meant, he was the Son of Man of Daniel 7:13. They thought he was Son of Man, Son of Joseph. And they didn't pick up on it. Now, he got more direct with them in the last 6 months of his ministry before the final Passover. But it wasn't time to be that direct earlier in his ministry. All right, let's go to chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of the king Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. All right, let me give you a little background here. Daniel was not known by Belshazzar. In chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall, it was the mother queen of Babylon who told Belshazzar, there is a person who explained visions or explained dreams to your grandfather, who was Nebuchadnezzar, and said who it was, brought him in, and he then, of course, said, explained the handwriting on the wall, and for that he made him the third person in the kingdom, because Belshazzar was the second person in the kingdom. The first person was Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus, who's not mentioned here in the book of Daniel because he wasn't in town at that time. Now, when you come to chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar. When's the first year of Belshazzar? He was co-regent with his father, Nabonidus. Nabonidus was out west, by the way, so he left everything under the control of his son. And he became the co-regent over Babylon in 553 B.C., in the middle of the 6th century, all right? And that was his first year. And that's when Daniel received the vision here in chapter 7. Belshazzar had not a clue. Didn't know anything about Daniel or about a vision. Then in chapter 8, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, which would be what? 550 B.C. He receives, in other words, 2 years later, another vision. And again, Belshazzar has not a clue of anything going on or that God is giving visions and dreams to Daniel. Now, it would be another, from the time of Daniel, of chapter 8, verse 1, it would be another 11 years before Belshazzar would be killed in October of 539 at the big party they were having to the Marduk and the other gods at that time of year. That's when Darius the Mede, after lowering the Euphrates River by canals, came in at night with a small group of men, went to the palace, killed the king, opened the gates. It was all over. And Daniel was known or made known in some way. And in fact, Darius seems to have had almost an instant liking to Daniel. And of course, then later Daniel, as we will see here, apparently goes to the capital of Persia, to that of Susa, not Babylon. And I'll explain as we go along a little bit more here. What you're going to see in this chapter 8. In chapter 7, the vision showed that there was four beasts and a little horn that followed with the fourth beast. All right, that was Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Rome would have 10 resurrections. There would be 10 horns plus a little horn that would follow and be a part of that overall fourth horn, which was Rome. Now, when chapter 8 is interesting, because chapter 8 is going to talk about the second beast and the third beast, Persia and Greece. And something is going to come out, especially when we get to the third one, that will be a type and will impact not only before Christ would come, 168 years before he would come, but also at the time of the end before his second coming. I'll tell you, it's the abomination of desolation. So let's look at the story here and how that God has given this vision to Daniel, and he is, of course, perplexed by everything. Verse 2, I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, that I was in Susa, or Shushan, the capital of Persia, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai, or actually it's a canal connecting two rivers. And then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Persia was greater than the Medes. Cyrus the Great came into power in Persia in about 558 B.C. One of his biggest contentions was the Midian Empire at the time, and so he attacked and defeated and killed the king of Midian. But not just conquering them, they became allies to him after their king was removed and killed by Cyrus, and so it became a combined Medo-Persian Empire, Persia being the greater of the two. One empire. Now, the reason why Nabonidus, he began to recognize, wait a minute here, I'm alarmed by what I see here. So he began to put three nations together, the three ribs that in chapter 7 it talks about here, in verse 5 of chapter 7. A second, like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth. Yes, it's devouring these three ribs. Nabonidus was trying to get an allegiance together, allies, Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia. Now, at that time, the Lydian Empire controlled what today is all of Asia Minor or Turkey. So Cyrus, then seeing what Nabonidus was doing, he began to attack to conquer. And he did conquer all three of them very, very quickly after he had conquered the Medes, and the Medes had become part of the Persians. So, you know, write that all down. I'll give you a test, and I want you to miss out on all of that. So that's a little bit of what happened here historically. All right? Verse 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. He certainly did. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth. In other words, very quickly, without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. It was Alexander the Great of the Greeks, and you'll see that in verse 20 and 21. So then he came to, I should mention before we go on, the Medo-Persian Empire lasted for over 200 years. They conquered Babylon in 339, so that ended the first beast, Babylon. The second beast officially then begins, as far as what we're looking at in prophecy, from 539 down to 331 B.C., a little over 200 years, Alexander the Great defeats the Persians in 531 B.C. he went everywhere. Well, actually, so did Cyrus the Great. One of the great kings during the 200-year reign of the Persians was Xerxes the Great. There's several things interesting about Xerxes. You know who his queen was? Esther in the Bible. Also, another thing that's interesting about Xerxes, when he crossed the Bosporus Dardanelles and attacking the Greeks in about 480 to 485 B.C., there was an individual courier who ran to tell the Greeks that the Persians had crossed the Dardanelles. He ran 26 miles to tell the general of the Greeks what had happened. Then he dropped dead of a heart attack. And from that, we get the marathon today. So, see what's come out of these things? And I mean, that's where the marathon race came from, the 26-mile race. All right. Well, when Alexander, who was actually spoke Greek, but he really wasn't a Greek. He was from Macedon, Philippi of Macedon. His father was Philip. Of Macedon, and the first of the Macedonian kings. But his son Alexander, at a very young age, was able to absolutely take over the most of all of the world at that time, clear to the Indus River of India. He conquered, like I say, the Persians in 331, but then guess what? In 323, he died. Now, there's two different theories. One is that he died of a fever. The other one is he was assassinated by one of his generals. I guess we don't know who it's going to, what the truth really is. Do you know that it was 400 years after his death before anybody ever wrote about him, of which we have any record today? And there are only two books, Greek books, that mention Alexander the Great and what he did, and they were written 400 years after his death. And the significance of that is when people are so critical of the Bible and the characters in the Bible, of which there are multiple things written about them both inside and outside the Bible, and yet they do not want to believe it. But they'll believe the two little accounts that we have, and which is all we have, of Alexander the Great. Movies will be made about it, everything. There'll be no question. is there a built-in bias or what? There than human nature. Okay, coming back here, let's go to, let's see, where did I leave off? well, let's across the surface. Okay, verse 6. So then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns, broke the power. And that was 331 B.C. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, and he cast him down to the ground, trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So that ended the Persian Empire. Well, it would come back later, but under different leadership. Verse 8, therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Alexander died, then four generals divided up the kingdom that he had conquered. The two principal ones that will be called the king of the north and the king of the south, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Ptolemy got Egypt. It was not the borders of Egypt as you see today. It went all the way through the Sudan, west to Libya, the areas even west of Benghazi. He built the Greeks built the city, the Greek city there, was it Cyrene? The one that carried the cross for Christ was of, what's his name, Alexander of Cyrene or whatever. Help me out if you can think of it. It was from that city. It was a city established by the Greeks because they controlled that portion of North Africa. He went all the way south to the Sudan and to Ethiopia. That was the kingdom of Ptolemy. And one of the last Ptolemies was Cleopatra. In the movies and everything, she was Greek and she was of the Ptolemies. The Seleucids, he made his capital in Babylon. And, of course, all of his descendants continued to carry the title of the Seleucid Empire. His empire went all the way to the Indus River in India. The other two generals, I forgot their names. I've got it written down here somewhere, but not on the page I'm looking at. the one got what we would call Turkey today, or Asia Minor, and the other one got Europe, that is Macedonia, Greece, and everything west of the Bosporus and the Dardanelles. All right, but the ones we're going to be concerned about are the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, kings of the north and kings of the south, and they will be discussed in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, but also right here for a specific reason. We're going to look here, first of all, at the one that we call the King of the North later, and you will read about this individual, Antiochus Epiphanes, in the 11th chapter of Daniel. Verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn. Well, didn't we just talk about a little horn in the previous chapter, part of the fourth beast? Here's a little horn, but this is part of the third beast. Okay, so we have two different little horns in the book of Daniel. And we want to keep them separate. A lot of critics have tried to put them together. Now, the one thing that's interesting is that this little horn in chapter 8 plays a very big part about as a type of that which will come at the time of the end of the age. Let's go on here. So out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. I want to read from Expositor's Bible Commentary a little bit, if you'll bear with me, on because a lot of prophecy is history, because it's been fulfilled once. Now, the abomination of desolation, the first time that it took place, was in 168 B.C. Daniel was receiving this prophecy or this vision when? In the third year of Belshazzar, which was 550 B.C. So you can see that it was about just a little under 400 years before the first abomination of desolation would come to pass. And it will have things in it that will be a part of what the final one will be like, which we will see at the end of this chapter. All right, let me pick up here. Where did I want to read? There it is. Verses 9 through 12 foretell the rise of a small horn from the midst of these four horns, the four generals of Alexander. It is described as attaining success and aggression against the south, or the domains of the Ptolemies in Egypt. This evidently refers to the career of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who usurped the Seleucid throne from his nephew, son of his older brother, Seleucus, I guess you'd say, IV, and succeeded in invading Egypt in 170 to 169 B.C. His expeditions against rebellious elements in Parthia, Josephus tells us that the Parthians were made up of the lost 10 tribes, or a part of them, and Armenia, were initially successful to the east as well, and his determination to impose religious and cultural uniformity on all his domains led to a brutal suppression of Jewish worship at Jerusalem and generally throughout Palestine. Here referred to as the beautiful land, the adornment, the pride, or the glorious land, the land of adornment or of glory. This suppression came to a head in December of 168 B.C. Now, how do we know it was December? Because in the book of Josephus, he tells us that it was in the 25th of Chislev, month of Chislev on the Hebrew calendar, which is December, C-H-I-S-L-E-V. And for 3 years. And then Judas Maccabeus brought it to an end on the 25th of Chislev, and 3 years later. So it lasted for 3 years, and it was in 168 when it was begun. Let me pick up where I left off. This suppression came to a head in December of 168 B.C. when Antiochus returned in frustration from Alexandria, Egypt, where he had been turned back by the Roman commander Popilius Lanius, and vented his exasperation on the Jews. He sent his general Apollonius with 20,000 troops under orders to seize Jerusalem on the Sabbath. There he erected an idol of Zeus and desecrated the altar by offering swine on it. This idol became known to the Jews as the Abomination of Desolation, which serves as a type of the future abomination that will be set up in Jerusalem, sanctuary to be built in the last days. And then in parentheses, Christ's prediction in Matthew 24 and in verse 15, the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. All right, let's read on here. Verse 10. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Well, now how could Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes do that and trample the stars, the angels of heaven, down to the ground? Well, did he? Well, no man can do that, obviously. Let's see something else here I'd like to mention. Continuing on with the predicted career of Antiochus in verse 10, we encounter the remarkable statement that he will grow up to the host of heaven and will throw some of the starry host down to the earth, where he will trample on them. Now the host is a term most often used of the armies of angels in the service of God, especially in the frequent title Yahweh or Yahweh of hosts, or else of the stars in heaven. But it is also used of the people of God who are to become as the stars in number, Genesis 12:3, Genesis 15:5, and in Exodus 12:41 are spoken of as, quote, the host of Yahweh, the Israelites coming out of Egypt, the Lord's divisions who went up out of the land of Egypt. So it is used here, obviously, as referring to the Jewish people and not referring to the angels in heaven. And you got to look at the context clearly. Antiochus Epiphanes, as evil as he was, did not have that kind of power. as I explained to one person over in Miami afterwards, I said, when you go to the book of Revelation and Satan tries to once again go up to heaven to conquer God, Revelation 12, he is cast down. Michael is the one who Christ uses to cast him down to the earth again, right? And then he goes out with great wrath because he knows he has only a little time left. Coming back here now, verse 11. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now, the term that he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. Antiochus Epiphanes, I should have looked it up. The word Epiphanes is a title given to him. He's Antiochus IV of the Seleucid Empire. And the Jews had a different name than Epiphanes. They called him something, the crazy one or whatever. In other words, he portrayed himself to be God. I'll go ahead of my story a little bit. How does he die? He is away when Judas Maccabeus and his armies that he has developed over 3 years finally conquered the Seleucid armies and cleansed the temple 3 years exactly after the abomination was set up. He was turning to come back to take on Judas Maccabeus and his army behind that he had. God stopped him the same way he did in the book of Acts to Herod Antipas, I believe his name was. Remember? Worms took over his intestines and worms and ulcers, and he died quickly. And so that ended his... God only allowed it for the time period that had been prophesied to carry out the prophecy. It was over with, and this person who claimed to be God and as a God was taken care of by God. You never want to do that, because when God... When the appointed time comes, he will take care of those who make such a blasphemous claim. Let me jump ahead. At the time of the end, there will be two individuals who would make such a blasphemous claim. What is Jesus Christ going to do when he returns? God's going to allow them to make that claim for 3.5 years or more. And when he returns in the 19th chapter of the book of Revelation, he's going to throw them into a lake of fire that will be burning at the south end of Jerusalem in the Valley of Hinnom. And that's how he'll take care of that. And nobody is going to get away with claiming to be God and be such a maniac as that. Anyhow, coming back here, that was to explain verse 11, exalting himself. How does he exalt himself? You know, there are people that actually do exalt themselves and think that they are a god. And many rulers in the special and classical history wanted to be worshipped as gods. Pharaohs did. This isn't the first one. But he does it and carries it away by desecrating the altar and the temple of God in Jerusalem. Verse 12, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn, the little horn, him, Antiochus Epiphanes, not the same horn as you read about in the previous chapter, to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. How did he cast truth down to the ground? Any Jew caught circumcising a baby would be killed, everyone killed. Anyone caught keeping the Sabbath was killed. That's how he trampled the truth down to the ground. Because anyone practicing the truth, living it or doing it, were to be automatically killed. 40,000 Jews were killed in Jerusalem. 40,000 more were taken into captivity and slavery at that time. Verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot or trampled? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, your center margin, if you have one, it will show you that it actually does not say days. It says evening and mornings, because you have two sacrifices a day, the evening and morning sacrifice. So as far as days, that would be 1,150 days, 2,300 divided in two. The Seventh-day Adventists have always wanted to insist on 2,300 days, even though the Hebrew doesn't say that. And so they would begin, I believe, with 457 B.C. and come forward, was it 2,300 years, a day for a year in prophecy, which they know about. And I forgot what that came to, 1844, I believe it was, when they were all out on a mountain or a hill in Michigan with sheets on, waiting for the second coming of Christ, which did not happen. It was kind of chilly that night, I'm sure, in Michigan. So then they thought they were off by 1 year, so they waited one more year to do it again, got the same result. But somehow they still cling to the fact that 2,300 days should be 2,300 years, and that they just misunderstood it. Well, they did. We have always understood that it's 1,150 days. It's evening and mornings. It's not days. Days is a mistranslation. 1,150 How long will the sacrifices be stopped? It apparently appears to be 1,150 days of the evening and morning sacrifices being stopped. That was ancient. It was 3 years from Cheslev to Cheslev, 3 years there that it was under desecration. Will that happen again, and will it be exactly that long? I don't know. This is a number you can't be dogmatic about in any way. Just keep filed away, and you have to wait and see. You know, it's kind of like Jacob when he heard about his son Joseph's dreams. At first he said, you know, who are you to be giving telling your brothers these dreams or whatever? But in the end of that chapter where it talks about it, he said, he kind of filed it away. He kept it in his mind wondering about it. Jacob did. In other words, was it going to be true or not? The dreams that Joseph had of being superior to his brothers. He couldn't tell because there was no way he could know. He did later, didn't he, when he came down to Egypt. Verse 15, now it happened that when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I had the appearance of a man, of course, was another angel. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. And so he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid. I fell on my face. And that's exactly what happens every time when a righteous angel appears, or especially in splendor. Now, many times angels have appeared to people and look just like their neighbor, you know, and you wouldn't know. But when they appear in splendor, or Jesus Christ on some occasions has appeared, and you'll see the capital letter angel in the Old Testament. For example, Joshua chapter 5. He is host of the armies of God. And Joshua fell down and he didn't get up. And it tells us that it was not a regular angel, because look what happens here when it is just an angel. Fell on my face, but he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. Stood me up. Now, if any of you have ever seen Benny Hinn on TV healing people, he has a person there to catch him, right? And be healed right in that forehead. What direction do they fall? Always back. You ever seen one fall forward? Never happens, does it? Tells you what spirit is involved there. Always, which in the Bible uses the term familiar spirit, they fall on their face. On their backs. But when it's God, they fall on their face. I'll tell on my sister. She'll find out probably at the end of 1,000 years. But anyhow, she's Mormon. And she was, when I was coming into the church and concerned about me, and come on over and let's have lunch and talk about everything. This had to do with Christmas. I think I mentioned something about this last week. And we're talking, and she gave me the book, the autobiography of Joseph Smith, and the Book of Mormon to take home and read. So I did. I didn't read it all. I just read a little bit of the autobiography of about the first few pages of the autobiography of Joseph Smith. You know why I didn't read any further? I'd been taking the Bible correspondence course. And I was far enough along, I knew and understood what this was here in verse 17, falling on your face. Because in one of those lessons in the Bible correspondence course, it was explained that demons fall on their back. Guess what? Joseph Smith was out in the woods of Palmyra, New York, as he writes in his autobiography, and he fell on his back, and looking up, he saw God the Father, Jesus Christ, and who else? Was it Peter, James, and John, or whatever? Now, I realize that he saw a spirit, all right, but he was not seeing God the Father or Jesus Christ and laying on his back, because had it really been, it wouldn't have been God the Father, first of all. Maybe possibly it could have been Jesus Christ. He would have been down for the count on his face, and he wouldn't have gotten up. If it had been a righteous angel, he would have gone down, like it says right here, and that angel would have gotten him up. The angel in the book of Revelation tells John to get up. You worship God, not me. And always keep that in mind. When you ever see anything like that, don't be fooled. People are fooled by things because they just don't know any better. All right, verse 19. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. Okay, really, two things are going to happen here. There's going to be two abominations. We already know of one. Verse 20, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And verse 21, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between the eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. All right. Right here, Bible interprets itself, right? And of course, Gabriel is giving the interpretation to Daniel, but he is not quite telling him everything, is he? I mean, he's telling him everything, but he doesn't. If you were alive in 550 BC and receiving this, and it's not going to be another 400 years before the first fulfillment comes, I mean, you know, it's going to be a mystery to you. We can look back because we have history now. And to see just how it was fulfilled the first time. Now, can you tell me exactly how it's going to be fulfilled the next time? In part, you can tell, I think, a little bit, but we don't know how it's all going to play out exactly, do we? So that's why we have to all be close to God and stay tuned. Let's see, verse 22, and as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms, this is Greece, shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power, not with the same power that the first horn or of the kingdom Greece had, Alexander the Great. All right, now here we go. Verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. Now, we're not talking just about talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, but he is a type of somebody that will even be worse than him, that will come in the latter time when Christ will return. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, no, by the power of Satan. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He will, just as Antiochus prospered and thrived for the 3 years. And when it was over, God took care of him. And this, you know, you think about Adolf Hitler. He was an incredible evil person who prospered and thrived from the time he became Chancellor of Germany all the way up into the 40s until it was at the very end that he was not going to win, especially at the after the Battle of the Bulge. That was it. Once they were defeated, they had nothing left to fight with. It was over. And time had come and run out on him. And it will run out on the one at the end of this age. Where am I? Verse 25. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand. Now, as we will see when we get to the 11th chapter, Antiochus Epiphanes, in fact, I read it here from the commentary, usurped. He was not the one to be next in line for the throne. And we have always believed that he is a type of the final one. And in chapter 11, I'm getting ahead of myself, it says he comes in, what, with intrigue, or in other words, friendly, peaceful, here's our man, you know, this kind of thing. And once he has consolidated power, look out. And if he came in as he really is, he wouldn't come in. He'd be stopped. He has to come in as, you know, Mr. Peace in order to get control of everything and then proceed to do what is prophesied that he will do. Now, through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart. How's he going to do that? That he is God. That's what it's talking about. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. Now, in the King James, it says, in peace, destroy many. And I think the King James is probably more correct here. In peace, he will destroy many. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, Jesus Christ. So this is talking now at the very end time before Christ, at the time of Christ's second coming. But he shall be broken without human hand. Now that is mentioned in two other places, isn't it? Remember the chapter 2? How does that fourth kingdom end? It is destroyed without hands. Chapter 11, verse 45, the last verse. After he hears tidings out of the north and out of the east, how is he destroyed? Again, without hands. In other words, God is the one who will take care of him, not the powers or of man on this earth. So, without human hand. Verse 26, and the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Well, it certainly does, like several millenniums into the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterwards, I rose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. And, of course, how could he fully understand everything that he was being given 400 years beforehand? Where was Daniel? Where were these empires in 550 B.C.? I mean, at that time, there was only one that he knew of, and that was the Babylonian Empire that he was serving under Belshazzar, who was the co-regent with his father. Where's this Persian Empire? Cyrus the Great hadn't become great yet when he received all of this. He had to be told by Gabriel about the Medes and the Persians. And over here in verse 21 about the Greeks. Because in Daniel's time, then 550 B.C., I mean, who are the Medes and the Persians? Who are the Greeks? You know, I mean, for sure, he knew of the Greeks because a lot of Jews, the Dorian Greeks were Jews that had settled in Greece. I mean, he's familiar, I'm sure, with the nations or the city-states of Greece and all of that. But as far as being a huge power, how would he have seen and been able to equate and understand that in 550 B.C.? So a lot of that's why Daniel had the problems, you know, understanding it, and it was a mystery to him. It would have been to you and I, too, had we lived at that time. All right, we're going to stop there and have a final song and prayer, and stick around. We got some food for everybody, too.